When Bo and Riley entered the marshal's office a short time later, Scratch grinned from the chair, which he had tipped back against the wall as usual.
That big boy didn't give us a lick of trouble. Went right into one of the cells, told us to be sure and wake him up for breakfast. He curled up on the floor like a big shaggy dog went off to sleep.
On the floor?
That's right. Didn't seem to bother him at all.
Rawhide was over at the stove, pouring herself a cup of coffee. As she turned toward the others, she lifted the cup toward them.
Reckon since I'm deputy now, I'm entitled to drink your coffee, too.
Help yourself. Oh, that's right. You already did.
She made a face at him, then perched a hip on a corner of the desk.
Now that I've got some authority, I want to do some more investigating about the rustling that's been going on up at the Rockin' Bee and the Star.
The Rockin' Bee would be Chet Bascom's spread, I take it.
And the Star belongs to Steve North.
The North Star?
Yeah, pretty bad, isn't it?
Fella's got a right to name his ranch whatever he wants to, I reckon.
You're going out there to poke around by yourself?
Why not?
Well, the last time you did that, you wound up being chased by a bunch of cowboys who were trying to shoot you, remember?
That won't happen this time. By the time I ride out there in a day or two, Bascom and North will have heard that I'm a deputy now, and they won't let their men shoot at an officer of the law. Both of those old-timers are rough as cobs, but they won't want the trouble that would come down on their heads if some of their hands killed a star packer. They're basically law-abiding gents, which is why I think somebody else is behind the cattle rustling, even though they've been blaming it on each other.
You're putting a lot of faith in a badge you don't even have.
Why, Marshal, you sound like you don't want anything bad to happen to me. I didn't think you cared.
If something happens to one of my deputies, it reflects badly on me, too. As well as on the office of the marshal. We're trying to get people around here to respect the law, and it won't help if you get yourself shot up.
I'll be careful. I know these parts and the folks who live here better than any of you three. I stand the best chance of finding out what's really going on out there.
All right. You might take Bo or Scratch with you, though, just in case.
I reckon, if I have to.
You know, we didn't quite finish making our rounds.
I plumb forgot about it after that fella came sailing through that plate glass window. How do you reckon he's doing?
One of us ought to go down to the docks and check on him.
I'll do that.
Rawhide left the office and headed for Doc Summers' place. Riley stayed to watch the prisoner, while Bo and Scratch walked down Main Street to the bridge and resumed making sure that the town was quiet and settled in for the night. Or, at least, as quiet and settled in as this section of the settlement was going to get. The two lawmen stayed together this time. As they passed the Royal Flush, they saw that the window through which Chesterfield Pike had tossed the luckless gambler was already boarded up. Dodge Emerson would have to get another pane of glass freighted up here from Santa Fe, which might be an expensive proposition. Bo recalled that Jonas McHale owned the local freight line. He was willing to bet that despite McHale's dislike for Emerson, the mayor would take the saloon keeper's money when it came to hauling freight. They didn't run into any more trouble this time. And they had returned to the bridge and were walking over the creek when Bo suddenly paused, tilted his head a little, and listened intently.
Hold on a minute.
What is it?
Soon Scratch heard the sounds of hoofbeats, and they were headed toward the two deputies in a hurry. The swift rataplan of a horse's hooves carried through the night air, growing louder as the rider approached Whiskey Flats from the south. The two men turned to look in that direction.
Sounds like whoever it is in a mite of a hurry.
A mighty big hurry.
Fella who's riding that fast is usually either running away from trouble or heading straight into it.
Town's quiet now, so the trouble must be behind him.
Sounds like one horse.
The rider had just reached the southern end of Main Street. Bo and Scratch could see him now as a fast-moving shadow in the darkness, although there wasn't enough light to make out any details yet.
Let's get off the bridge. Maybe we can stop him and find out what's going on.
They hurried off the planks and took up positions at the southern end of the bridge. The horse and rider thundered closer. Bo waved his arms over his head and shouted,
"Hold it! Hold it there, Mr. Rein In!
Stop in the name of the law!"
None of it did any good. The horse continued to bolt. Bo could see now that the rider was slumped forward over the animal's neck, apparently either unconscious or dead. There was no telling how long the horse had been running. It looked to be out of its head. The horse pounded on across the bridge. The way it was going, it might have kept running all the way to Colorado if not for the fact that the slight jolt of going on to and then off of the bridge had unbalanced the rider. As he and Scratch ran across the bridge, Bo thought the rider was lucky that neither of his feet had caught in the stirrup when he fell. If that had happened, he likely would have been dragged to his death, assuming, of course, that he hadn't already crossed the divide. Relieved of the burden it had been carrying, the panic-stricken horse finally slowed and then stopped. As they came closer, Bo saw that the horse wasn't wearing a saddle. That was why the rider hadn't gotten a foot caught in a stirrup. The animal had only a rope hackamore strapped on its head. Bo and Scratch hurried toward the rider, who lay motionless in the street. When they came closer, they could tell that the rider wasn't a man at all, but rather a boy in his early teens. Bo felt a cold chill go through him at the sight of the dark blotches on the boy's shirt. Those were bloodstains, which meant that the youngster was hurt.
We need to be careful with him. Scratch, strike a match.
Scratch took a lucifer from his pocket and snapped it into life with his thumbnail. The harsh glare from the sulfur match revealed the youngster's pale, haggard face. He was a towhead, 13 or 14 years old.
Huh. Never seen him before, but that ain't surprising seeing as how we ain't been around these parts for very long. You know him, Bo?
Bo was carefully pulling aside the youngster's shirt to check the wounds.
No, I don't recognize him. Looks like the bullet just knocked a chunk out of his side. Probably hurts like blazes and has lost quite a bit of blood. But if we get him to the doc right away, I think he'll be all right.
You sure he was shot?
Best I can tell in this light. Give me a hand with him, then see if you can catch his horse. Might give us a clue as to who he is, although I'm betting somebody around here will know him.
With Scratch's help, Bo lifted the limp form and cradled it in his arms. He started toward the doctor's office, which he had visited a couple of times before to make the acquaintance of Dr. Edwin Summers and to check on the wounded prisoners who were still at the doc's place. Scratch followed behind, leading the boy's horse. The mount had been too exhausted to even shy away as Scratch caught hold of the trailing reins.
Boy must have been bound and determined to make it to town. He managed to hang on to the reins even after he passed out so the horse would keep on running.
Yeah, I hope the doc can bring him around so he can tell us what he was running from.
As far as Bo could tell, there had been no immediate pursuit behind the boy. The night remained quiet now that the pounding hoofbeats were stilled. Of course, that didn't really mean anything. Deadly danger was often quiet, like a scorpion crawling in a man's boot, or a bushwhacker clutching a rifle in his sweaty hands while he waited for a target to appear in his sights. Dr. Edwin Summers was waiting on the porch of his house when Bo and Scratch arrived with the wounded youngster. Rawhide was with him. Bo recalled that Rawhide had come up here to check on the injured gambler.
Bring him on inside, Mr. Creel.
It looks like the boy's been shot. The slug left a pretty deep graze on his right side.
Summers nodded and stepped aside. He was a slender man of medium height with thinning dark hair and a neat goatee. His thin face usually had a solemn cast to it, probably the result of all the pain and suffering he had seen in his medical career. Bo carried the youngster on into the house, the front several rooms of which contained Summers' medical practice. The doctor ushered them into a small room furnished with an examination table and several cabinets full of medicine and medical instruments. A couple of lamps hung from the ceiling so that the table was particularly well lit. Following Summers' orders, Bo placed the boy on the table and stepped back. He had blood on his hands. Summers handed him a clean towel to wipe them, then bent to examine the wound in the boy's side.
My God, I know that kid. He's the Thompson boy. Lester Thompson, I think his name is. His family has a little spread south of here, what some folks call a greasy sack outfit. They raise horses mostly.
I concur with your diagnosis, Mr. Creel. The bullet didn't penetrate, simply plowed a furrow through the upper layers of flesh, causing blood loss and tissue damage. There was a time when such a wound might have proven fatal due to blood poisoning, but now, as long as it's cleaned properly and kept clean, I see no reason why the boy shouldn't recover. I'll get started right away.
Summers cut the rest of the blood-stained shirt away.
When do you think he'll wake up so he can tell us what happened, Doc?
There's no way of knowing. He's passed out from loss of blood. He might come around at any time, or he may not wake up until tomorrow morning.
He began using a wet cloth to swab away the dried blood around the wound. When he had done that, he soaked another cloth with carbolic acid and started cleaning the wound itself.
You men hold him so he doesn't move around.
Bo and Scratch stepped forward to do so. As they gripped Lester's shoulders, Summers resumed wiping carefully at the wound, which slowly welled blood. Suddenly, the boy's eyes popped open and his head jerked up. A second later, however, it became obvious that he wasn't screaming in pain.
Engines! Oh God, Paul, watch out! Apache!
Then his head fell back to the table as unconsciousness claimed him again.
Did he say Apaches?
That's what he said, all right.
But I thought Indians used bows and arrows.
They did in the old days. Some still do. But the white man taught them how to use guns, too. along with a lot of other things they learned from us, like scalping and breaking treaties.
Most Apaches are as good or better with a rifle than most white men. Some of them even carry revolvers and can handle them pretty well, although I never saw one who claimed to be a fast draw. They don't go in for that kind of boastfulness. They take their killing serious-like.
There hadn't been any Indian trouble around here in a long time. Close to 10 years, probably.
What about what happened to Harry Winston's wife?
That was just one lone renegade off on a loco killing spree. It's not anywhere near the same as a war party attacking a ranch.
We don't know for sure that's what happened here. All we got to go on is what one kid said, and he's probably out of his head from the pain of his wound.
Lester Thompson's a pretty level-headed boy. I don't think he would have imagined such a thing as an Indian attack.
There's only one way to find out for sure. We'll have to ride out to the Thompson spread and have a look. Let's head back to the office and inform the marshal.
Tonight?
Rawhide, how far from the town is the Thompson place?
8 or 10 miles. It's pretty much due south of Whiskey Flat, so you can't miss it.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but in the time it took that yunker to ride from there into town, whatever was happening at his folks' place got over and done with. We'll ride out there in the morning and see how bad it is. Be enough light then to pick up the trail of the war party, too.
Scratch is right. For now, it would probably be a good idea if we kept what we've heard here tonight to ourselves.
You mean we shouldn't warn the townspeople that the Apaches are raiding again? I don't like the sound of that. Folks have a right to know if they're in danger.
I don't think there's much danger of the town being attacked. Apache war parties are usually small. They target isolated ranches, like the Thompson spread.
I ain't like the Comanche. I recollect a time back when Bo and me were young, when a giant war party rode down out of Comancheria and raided all the way to the Gulf Coast, laying waste to the towns they come to on the way. Apaches don't hardly ever do anything like that.
But they could.
Oh, a fella could go plumb loco trying to predict what an Indian will do. You never can tell.
But I can guarantee that if you start running up and down the street yelling about Apaches, you'll have a panic on your hands, and probably for no good reason. Let us check it out in the morning, and we'll figure out what we need to do next.
That's exactly right, Deputy. Last thing we need right now is for the citizens of Whiskey Flats to panic. We'll stand guard all night, though, so just in case there's an attack, the town will have some advance warning.
Good thinking, Marshal. I suspect that the kid will be awake in the morning if you want to talk to him before we ride out to his parents' ranch. Dr. Summers couldn't guarantee it, though, and he won't allow the kid to be disturbed if he's still resting.
I reckon we already got an idea what we're gonna find out there, and it ain't gonna be anything good.
The four of them switched off standing guard during the night, two at a time, one at each end of town. Just because the Apaches had attacked a ranch south of Whiskey Flats didn't necessarily mean that any attack on the settlement would come from that direction. Since Scratch and Rawhide had worked together before, Bo suggested that the two of them take the first turn before Riley could suggest that he and the young woman stand guard together. Bo figured that Riley was too nervous about the Indians to get any romantic notions, and they would have been at opposite ends of the town anyway, but in the long run, it was better not to put temptation in Jake Riley's path. He didn't have a good history of resisting it. Riley went to his room in the hotel to get a little sleep. Bo stayed in the marshal's office in jail, where Chesterfield Pike was still snoring peacefully, if loudly. Like most frontiersmen, Bo had picked up the knack of being able to doze off wherever and whenever he got the chance, so Pike's stentorian rumbling didn't disturb him at all. He took off his hat and coat, but not his gun belt and boots, stretched out on one of the cots, and was asleep in less than a minute. He slept dreamlessly until Scratch woke him with a hand on the shoulder and a low-voiced word. Bo came awake instantly, fully alert, another trait that most men in the West had developed if they wanted to live very long.
Everything's quiet. Ain't seen hide nor hair of any hostiles, and neither is a gal.
Doesn't surprise me. I figure it was a fairly small group of bucks. They wouldn't want anything to do with taking on a town this size.
You want me to go wake up the kid?
Nah, I'll do it.
Well, then. I'm turning in, then. I ain't so young as I used to be, and these night watches get to be a mite long and tedious.
At this hour of the morning, the street on this end of town was quiet and dark. Although a few lamps turned low still burned in a few of the buildings, and the lobby of the hotel was lit up. As Beau passed the alley that ran next to the Morning Glory Cafe, he glanced along it and saw a light burning in the kitchen window. Velma Dearborn and Ole Borglund were probably in there already, preparing for breakfast. Running a cafe in a frontier town meant long, hard hours. At least the window of the room where Harry Winston was staying was dark. Beau hoped that meant the former lawyer and future judge, if everything went as planned, was sleeping. Winston ought to be getting over the worst of his sickness soon. Beau hoped that he wouldn't hear about the Apache raid on the Thompson Ranch. Such a reminder of what happened to his wife might set him back and cause him to lose all the progress he had made so far. That was another reason for keeping the news quiet for now. He went into the hotel lobby, which was deserted at this time of night. Keeping his steps light, Beau ascended the stairs. He paused in front of the door to Riley's room and rapped softly on it. Riley didn't answer.
Marshall, it's Beau Creel.
Beau tried the door and found it unlocked. He opened it and stepped into the dark room, feeling his skin crawling as he did so. He had never liked setups like this. His hand dropped to the butt of his gun, and his fingers closed around the walnut grips. Beau relaxed and grinned to himself. Everybody in Whiskey Flats was sawing logs tonight. The lamps in the hallway were out, but enough light came from downstairs for him to be able to make out Riley's sleeping form in the bed. Beau stepped over to him and gave his shoulder a shake.
Rise and shine, Marshal.
Indians!
Even though Beau was startled, he reacted quickly. He grabbed Riley, pushed him back down in the bed, and clamped a hand over his mouth.
Hush, Marshal. It's me, Beau. Settle down now. Are you all right now, Marshal? You know who I am?
Beau felt Riley's head bob up and down and took his hand away from the young man's mouth.
Time to wake up and stand our turn on guard, Marshal. Scratch and Rawhide didn't have any trouble during their turn.
Oh, I was dreaming. This big Indian, as big as Chesterfield Pike, was trying to scalp me. Indians don't grow that big, do they?
Some do, but it's rare. Just like it's rare to see a white man as big as Pike. Anyway, you don't have to worry about an Indian like that scalping you.
Why not?
Because any Indian that big would probably just pull your arms right off and beat you to death with him.
Oh.
Riley's outburst was the most excitement either of them had the rest of the night. Whiskey Flats continued its tranquil slumber until the sky turned gray with the approach of dawn and folks started moving around. Beau, Scratch, Riley, and Rawhide met at the marshal's office, Rawhide knuckling sleep out of her eyes as she came in.
I stopped by Doc Summers' place and Lester isn't awake yet. Doc says we can't wake him up either because he needs all the rest he can get. So, do we get mounted up and ride out to the Thompson spread to find out what happened?
You don't. We do.
I told you that I wasn't going to let you stick me here at this jail all the time. And now what do you do first thing?
This is different, Rawhide. We may run into a whole band of Apache out there. I'm sorry, but no man is going to let a woman deliberately risk that.
Especially not a Texan.
Besides, we have a prisoner here, remember? Somebody has to keep an eye on Pike. I want to keep him locked up for another day if we can, so when you talk to Jonas McHale about a hearing, see if he can't come up with some reason to postpone it for a day or two.
Chesterfield won't like it, and neither will Dodge Emerson. He'll have that tame lawyer of his, Carruthers, up here spouting all sorts of habeas corpus malarkey and things like that.
Yeah, well, you'll just have to fend him off. Tell him that you can't take the responsibility for making any decisions. And tell him that I told you to keep Pike locked up, and that's that.
Oh, all right. But it's not fair. The three of you riding off to have all the fun.
The men took their Winchesters and plenty of ammunition as they rode out of Whiskey Flats, heading south, generally following the course of the meandering stream that looped through Whiskey Flats and divided the town into two distinct sections.
I don't know what that gal expects us to find out here, but I'm sure as hell willing to bet that it won't be fun.
I'm not sure about this. I mean, Indian fighting doesn't fall under a marshal's normal duties, does it? Shouldn't we be getting the army to chase those Apaches or something?
We'll be a lot more likely to get some action out of the army if we have something specific to report to them.
In other words, those soldier boys don't like to jump until they know what they're jumping into.
Well, what if the Indians are still there?
Don't worry. We won't just ride in blind. We'll do a little scouting first.
When Bo and Scratch thought that they had covered enough ground to be getting close to the Thompson Ranch, they slowed their pace and began dismounting and checking before they topped each hill or rounded each sharp bend in the trail. It was still only mid-morning when Scratch came back down the slope of a wooded ridge on foot.
The spread's on the other side, about 500 yards away. I didn't see nothing moving around except some buzzards.
About what we expected. We're going slow and easy, ready for trouble.
If you fellas are sure about this, after all these chances we've wound up taking since we came to Whiskey Flats, though, there'd better be a damn good payoff when we get to the end of this.
There will be.
Scratch mounted up again, and they edged their horses forward, riding to the top of the ridge. Now all three men could see the layout. Rawhide had described the Thompson Ranch as a greasy sack outfit, a small ranch usually operated by a family, where the men would carry their lunch in a sack when they set out on the day's work, rather than returning to headquarters for the midday meal. The Thompson place certainly qualified. The main house, from the looks of it, once a sturdy log structure, was now a burned-out shell. The same was true of the barn and the other outbuildings. The raiders had set them on fire before leaving. The lack of a bunkhouse told Bo and Scratch that all the hands had lived in the main house and were probably related. They had seen dozens, maybe hundreds of small spreads like this, both in Texas and in their wanderings elsewhere on the frontier.
You're right. Nothing moving. They've been here and gone, just like we thought.
Spread out some, Riley. We want distance between us while we ride down there. No reason to clump up and give anybody who might be lurking around a bunch of easy targets.
I thought you said they were gone.
Sometimes the next day, an Indian will come back to a place he's raided, just on a chance that he might be able to jump anybody who comes to check on it. That don't mean they're here. You might not be in Apache within 20 miles.
But that don't mean they ain't here either. That's why we're being careful.
The riders spaced themselves out about 20 yards apart as they started down the slope toward the ranch. Their eyes moved constantly, always on the alert for any sign of danger. An eerie quiet hung over the place, broken only by the angry cries and flapping wings of the buzzards who rose into the air when the humans came too close. Bo pointed to a couple of bloody, furry shapes.
They're the dogs. Looks like they've been shot to pieces.
Man just inside the door of the barn. He's probably running out to see what was going on when they shot him. Slugs knocked him over backward.
But where are the rest of the people? I only see the one man Scratch pointed out.
There's a fella by the corral.
I don't see... You mean that pile of rags?
Those ain't rags. Apache skinned him, bit by bit. That's what's left.
I'm sorry I asked.
Scratch was even with the front door of the house now, so he reined to a halt and swung down from the saddle. Still holding his Winchester ready for instant use, he stepped to the doorway and peered inside for a long moment.
Anything?
Hard to tell because of the fire. Looks like a couple of women. Four little ones. And a couple of half-grown boys. From the looks of it, I expect they put up a hell of a fight.
Bo walked his horse over and stopped to look around the place for another minute or so. Then he pointed toward the barn.
Lester and his pa were in there tending to their evening chores. Somebody in the house spotted the Indian sneaking in and yelled. Thompson ran out, ran right into a bullet, like you said, Scratch. Before he died, he told Lester to grab a horse and ride for help. I reckon Lester didn't want to go, but he's a good boy and did what his pa told him. One of the Apaches winged him when he made his dash, but that didn't stop him. Then they laid siege to the house, and finally either got inside or just set it on fire and let that do the job for them. We'll know more when we get the bodies out to bury them.
How in the hell do you know all that?
Well, some of it's an educated guess, but the tracks tell the rest of the story. There were 9 of the Apaches.
I make it 10.
9 or 10 Apaches. Most of them, maybe all of them, were armed with Winchesters.
You can't possibly know that.
And look at all the brass laying around. An Indian's got no way of reloading cartridges, so he leaves his empty shells where they fall when the rifle kicks them out. Enough of them around so that there had to be quite a few guns being used. Open your eyes, Marshal.
But you can't expect me to know all this. I'm not a damn Marshal. I'm a gambler.
And a crook. Don't forget that part.
What was that about finding out whether the Indians got inside the house before they burned it down?
That's a good question. That's how you learn things, Jake, by asking questions.
And by watching hombres who already know what they're doing, like me and Bo.
Well, if it's such a good question, what's the damn answer?
If the children each have a single bullet hole in the head, it means the women finished them off before they could die in the fire and before the Apaches could get them. If that's the case, the women probably died of gunshot wounds to the head, too.
But I'll bet those older boys went down fighting. I just got a feeling about them. That Lester is plenty tough riding all the way into town with that bullet wound in his side. And odds are those other hombres were his brothers.
My God, you sound almost proud of them.
We are proud of them. How a man dies is sometimes just as important as how he lived. In a case like this, where those boys didn't get to live out their full span, the way they died is even more important.
They stood up and fought. Empty shells all around both of them. They didn't ask for what came at them, but they didn't run from it either. A man who turns and runs from trouble ain't worthy of being called a man. Lowest thing on the face of the earth as far as I'm concerned. But I can tell you one thing right now. Those two boys, they were men.
I don't understand. Dead's dead, no matter how you got that way.
You live long enough, you'll figure it out. We got some burying to do.
We're not going back to town to get the Undertaker?
This was their home. They died fighting for it. Reckon this is where they'd want to be.
By the middle of the day, the ashes had cooled enough for Bo and Scratch to retrieve the bodies from the house. They had spent the time before that burying the man they had found just inside the barn and the one who had fallen beside the corral. They had buried the dogs as well, knowing that the animals had died fighting against the invaders and deserved to be laid to rest properly. Riley helped with the work, although he looked sickened during most of it. As Bo and Scratch had suspected, the younger children inside the house had each died of a gunshot to the head, one or both of the women choosing to spare them the agonies of dying in the fire. The women had given themselves the same mercy, one falling with a bullet in the back of the head, the other, the last one, snuffing out her own life with a shot to the temple. Bo couldn't imagine the horror that lone woman must have felt, surrounded by flames and by the bodies of her loved ones, in that moment before she pulled the trigger and ended it all. That final shot had been mercy indeed. They couldn't dig graves for everybody, so they buried the little ones together, the boys in one grave, the women in another, the men in yet another. It wasn't a very satisfactory arrangement, but it was the best they could do. When they were finished and all the dirt had been heaped over the fresh graves, Bo and Scratch took off their hats, prompting Riley to do so as well. The young man even bowed his head this time as Bo said a prayer for the souls of those who had died here. That was progress, Bo thought. Riley wasn't thinking only of himself all the time anymore. Riley turned away from the graves and lifted his hat to put it on. A bullet tore the black Stetson from his hand. Bo and Scratch slapped leather and spun toward the sound of the shot. Another rifle spat lead behind them, though, and only a swift, instinctive move by Scratch kept the bullet from hitting him. Bo snapped a shot toward a flicker of movement at the corner of the barn.
Spread out! Move, Jake! Don't let him pin you down!
From the corner of his eye, Bo saw Riley scramble to his feet and dash for cover, triggering his six gun as he ran. Riley flung himself behind the horse trough near the barn, which had survived the fire and had been left alone by the Apaches, except for defecating in the water to foul it. Scratch, meanwhile, rolled under the bottom rail of the empty corral and came up in a crouch behind one of the corner posts. The post didn't provide much cover, but the silver-haired Texan didn't need much. As a bullet struck the post and sent splinters flying in the air, Scratch drew a bead and fired. An Indian jerked back into cover behind some brush, his bullet-busted arm flopping limply as he did so. That Apache was just wounded, not dead, so he couldn't be counted out of the fight. Scratch took advantage of the brief respite to rattle his hocks and head for the far side of the corral. Bo had cut away from the graves at an angle, putting some distance between himself and Scratch and Riley. With bullets kicking up dirt and pebbles around his feet, he made it to some pines and ducked behind the shelter of the thick trunks. The way the shots had been ringing out, it was impossible to tell for sure just how many attackers there were. Bo guessed 3 or 4, which meant that he and his companions were pretty evenly matched. At the moment, though, he, Scratch, and Riley were armed only with handguns. They had put their Winchesters back in the saddle sheaths while they worked on the graves. Since they were facing enemies with rifles, that put them at a disadvantage. There was nothing they could do except try to make the best of it, though. Bo began working his way through the trees, moving carefully and using every bit of cover he could find. Bullets hummed through the branches, but the riflemen were firing blindly, hoping to score with a lucky shot. Over by the barn, Riley lay on his belly behind the water trough, Colt clutched tightly in his hand. A few bullets had struck the heavy wooden trough, but they didn't penetrate. A sudden cracking sound came from behind Riley, causing him to roll over onto his back. The bullet smacked into the ground where Riley had been lying. He jerked up his gun as he saw the Apache trying to lever the Winchester he had just fired. The Indian must have stepped on a partially burned timber that had cracked the rest of the way under his weight. The Colt roared and bucked twice in Riley's hand, and the Apache, clad in blue tunic, breech cloth, and buckskin leggings, was driven backward by the bullets plowing into his chest. Scratch was making for the corner of the barn when he heard the shots and glanced over to see Riley firing into the ruins. He didn't have a chance to see how that turned out because he reached the corner of the barn and ducked down behind the partially collapsed wall. The last time he'd seen the Apache he'd winged, the varmint had been coming this way. He heard a rustling in the brush now and turned in that direction. Instinct warned him at the last second, or maybe it was a slight sound. Scratch ducked as the Indian tried to lunge over the top of the ruined wall and grab him from behind. Scratch reached up, clamped his free hand around the Apache's arm, and hauled him forward over the wall. Scratch twisted hard on the arm he held, pressing it beyond the endurance of flesh and muscle and bone until the Apache's elbow dislocated. Scratch stepped back and covered him. He saw that this was the Apache he had wounded before, as he had thought it would be. Now the hombre had two bum arms and wouldn't be a threat anymore. That was what Scratch thought, anyway. Even in agonizing pain from the bullet wound in one arm and the dislocated elbow on the other, the Indian came up off the ground and charged at Scratch, lowering his head as if he intended to butt the Texan in the chest.
Why, you crazy!
Scratch grabbed the Apache's tunic, used the man's own momentum against him, and flung him over the top of the wall. Scratch looked over the top of the collapsed wall. The Apache had fallen on a jagged piece of timber sticking up from the ruins, and his weight had been enough to drive the sharp wood right through his body. The bloody piece of wreckage protruded a good 4 inches from his chest. Scratch had time now to note that he was young, probably not out of his teens.
Whew! Damn!
Scratch shook his head and started to turn away. He wouldn't have killed a helpless man intentionally, even one who'd taken part in the atrocity that had happened here at the Thompson Ranch. Sometimes, fate had other things in mind, though. Like one of the bastards sneaking up on him and drawing a bead on him. Scratch knew as soon as he saw the Indian peering at him over the barrel of a rifle that he was done for. He didn't have time to raise the Remington and fire before the Apache could drill him. The shot that blasted out didn't come from the Indian, though. The Apache folded up, dropping the rifle before he could pull the trigger. Bo stepped out from behind a tree, lowering his Colt.
You took your damn time about it.
If you want to overwhelm somebody with gratitude, better look the other way. I would have gotten here too late.
Scratch looked over and saw Riley peering over the top of the trough, a gun in the young man's fist. Scratch realized now that Bo was on the wrong side of the Apache to have fired the fatal shot.
You mean he saved my life?
I reckon so.
I hit him. I aimed and all, but I didn't actually think I'd hit him. I just wanted to distract him.
Well, you distracted him pretty much to death. And I'm obliged, Riley. I really am.
But are there any more of them?
If there were, they'd be shooting at us by now.
Bo walked toward the Indian Riley had shot. He towed the man over onto his back.
Just a kid. Not more than 16, I reckon.
Same with the one I killed in the barn. Might have been a little older than that, but not much. He must have been with a war party last night and couldn't resist coming back today to see the results of their handiwork. The older bucks had sense enough to stay away. Coming back cost these young'uns their lives.
But you killed one in the barn. I killed one in the barn. Hey, I just realized. I got 2 out of the 3 of them. How about that?
Who gets how many ain't important. What matters is that they're dead and we ain't.
Wish we could have taken one of them alive.
Bo bent to pick up the rifle the Apache had dropped.
I'd like to know where they got these nice new Winchesters.
Don't you reckon they stole them somewhere?
Not rifles this new. I'd be willing to bet not more than 50 rounds have been fired from this gun. Let's check the others.
They found the Winchesters that had been used by the other two Indians, and the weapons were just as new and shiny as the first one Bo had looked at. a lot newer and shinier than the ones carried by Riley and the Texans, in fact.
Well, son of a bitch. You know what this means, Bo.
He may know, but I sure as hell don't. What are you two looking so grim about?
I haven't heard anything about any shipments of rifles being stolen in these parts lately. That means there's probably only one way these Apaches got their hands on these guns. Somebody sold them to them.
What do you mean, sold them to them? Who'd sell guns to the Apaches? Surely you don't mean a white man would do something like that.
A white man who didn't give a damn about anything except the money he could make from the deal. A fella like you ought to be able to understand that.
And what do you... Why, of all the... Damn it, I never did anything as bad as selling guns to the Indians. None of my cons cost anybody their lives. These poor people might have died because those Apaches had new rifles. If they hadn't been so well armed, the Thompsons might have been able to fight them off.
You've swindled money from people who couldn't afford to lose it. You don't know what effect that had on them. You had your loot, so you took off with a tall and uncut and never looked back.
So what? I'm not responsible for the well-being of every fool in the world. Anyway, you're a fine one to talk, Creel. You're the one who came up with the idea of me pretending to be John Henry Braddock so we could make a killing from the people of Whiskey Flats.
Maybe so. We all have lapses.
Not to hear you talk. To hear you and Scratch tell it, you're both perfect. You know all there is to know about the frontier and how real men act. Well, blast it! I'm getting tired of it. I can be just as much of a man as either of you two.
I'll believe that when I see it.
Well, maybe you will see it. I say we find out who sold those guns to the Apaches and bring the son of a bitch to justice.
That's what you want to do?
Damn straight.
That means postponing our original plans.
I don't care about that right now. I'm tired of that superior attitude you and Scratch have all the time. I say we find those gun-running skunks no matter how long it takes.
Might help Rawhide run those rustlers to ground, too.
Fine by me.
All right, then. We'll do it. For the time being, we'll do more than act like real lawmen. We'll be real lawmen. As much as if you were really John Henry Braddock, Jake.
Now you're talking. We better play our cards pretty close to the vest, though. Whiskey Flats is the only settlement in these parts, so it's possible that somebody in town might be mixed up in selling these guns to the Indians.
Somebody like that Emerson fella. You seem pretty slick, like the sort of gent who might do something like that.
We'll find out. But for now, Jake's right. We'll keep our suspicions to ourselves. We need to do something about these hombres, too. Nobody in town has to know about our fracas with them yet.
We passed a nice deep ravine back that way. Drop them in there and nobody will find them for a while. If ever.
That's the practical solution. Let's take care of that and head back to the settlement.
Did they have any horses?
Unlikely. Apaches have a taste for horse meat, but not much use for them as mounts. An Apache warrior in his prime can trot all day and cover as much or more ground than a good saddle horse.
We'll have to haul the bodies to that ravine on our horses. I don't much cotton to that idea, but we don't really have any choice.
They loaded the bodies on their horses. The animals were made skittish by the smell of blood, but Bo, Scratch, and Riley were able to control them. Then they started off toward the ravine.
I've noticed something about you two.
What's that?
Everywhere you go, sooner or later, there are dead bodies to take care of.
Yeah, I know. And it is a plumb vexation because we are peaceable men. Ain't that right, Bo?
Peaceable men? You can ask anybody.
Not anybody. You can't ask these Injuns now, can you?
It was mid-afternoon when the three men rode back into Whiskey Flats, and one look at the townspeople, calmly going about their business, was enough to tell Bo that Rawhide and Doc Summers had succeeded in keeping the news of the Apache raid on the Thompson Ranch a secret. It couldn't stay under wraps forever, though. The folks who lived here had a right to know that they might be in danger. Also, the three men agreed on the ride back into town. If someone in Whiskey Flats really was involved with selling rifles to the Apaches, it might be easier to flush him out if they revealed what had happened to the Thompson family. Accordingly, they planned to talk to Major Jonas McHale and have him call a town meeting, at which Riley could announce what had happened. Before that, though, they wanted to check in with Rawhide Abbott and find out if anything new had happened while they were gone. Naturally enough, folks noticed their return, and as Bo had suspected, Ike had done his gossipy work well. Everyone was curious about why the three lawmen had ridden out early that morning, before most people were up. They reined in at the marshal's office and dismounted, leaving their horses at the hitch rail as they went inside. The men stopped short as they saw that the office was empty. The door to the cell block was open, though.
Hey, did somebody just come in?
Where's Rawhide? I thought we told her to stay here.
Might have been some trouble elsewhere in town. She might have felt that as a deputy, she had to go see about it.
There's some commotion south of the bridge, I'll bet.
If you fellas just come on back here and I'll tell you where Miss Rawhide went.
Bo and Scratch looked at each other and shrugged. Along with Riley, they went into the cell block. Pike stood there, seeming to fill up the cell with his massive body. Both hands gripped the bars of the door, and he looked like he could simply tear it off its hinges without much effort.
It's getting on past dinner time. Is Miss Velma going to bring me my food again? I sure do like her cooking. Now, she brought me my breakfast this morning.
Forget about eating for a minute. You said you'd tell us where Rawhide is.
Oh, yeah. Avella come in and told her there'd been some more rustling somewhere. Let me see if I can recollect where. Someplace called the Star Ranch. Mm-hmm. Must have been the owner, because he sure was mad about his cows getting stole. Said him and his men were going to ride over to the Rockin' Bee and burn it down because he was tired of those no-good rustling skunks or Bascoms getting away with it. Say, I remember that pretty good, didn't I?
How long ago did this happen?
Hell, now how would I know? I ain't got a watch, and I've dozed off a mite since then. Nothing else to do in here. Say, I thought there was supposed to be a trial or something. That tin-horned gambler needs to get what's coming to him.
Never mind that. There'll be a trial soon enough. It's the middle of the afternoon now. North had to have come in sometime after we left. What did Rawhide say to the man who came in?
Well, she told him not to fly off the handle. She said she'd take care of things because she was a deputy now. Vella just laughed at that, said he'd never heard of no gal deputy before. He left right after that, and so did Miss Rawhide. Say, Miss Rawhide's all right, ain't she? Now, she's always been nice to me every time I come into town. One of the few folks who treat me decent.
What do you think she'd do in a situation like that?
You know damn well what that red-headed firebrand would do. She'd lit a shuck for Bascom's place, figuring that she'd beat North and his crew there and try to head off the range war.
I agree. We better get out there as fast as we can.
Yeah, there's one problem with that. I don't know where Bascom's ranch is. Do either of you?
Well, we'll have to ask somebody.
I can take you.
You know where Chet Bascom's ranch is?
Sure. I know everybody in these parts. I just don't care to have much to do with them, mostly. And sometimes I have trouble recollecting names, mind you, but now that I think about it, I know where to find the Rockin' Bee and the Star Ranch, too. Let me out, and I'll show you.
I'll get the keys.
Chesterfield Pike's big mule had been taken to the livery stable the night before. Scratch went to fetch it, along with fresh horses for Bo, Riley, and himself. Their regular mounts had already made the ride to the Thompson Ranch today, and they weren't up for another hard run just yet. Mayor McHale was in his office at the stable, but came out when he heard Scratch's voice.
Deputy Morton, I heard that you and Marshal Braddock and Deputy Creel rode out early this morning as if there was some sort of trouble. What's going on?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mayor, but I ain't got time to talk about it right now. Me and Bo and the Marshal got things under control, though. You can count on that.
Well, that doesn't reassure me much, Deputy. As mayor, I want to know what things you have under control.
Yep, you have to take that up with the marshal. We got a skedaddle.
Deputy Morton!
The horses and Pike's mule were saddled by now, and Scratch took all the reins from Ike. Scratch ignored McHale as he turned and led the animals away from the livery barn. The mayor could get red-faced and huffy all he wanted to as far as Scratch was concerned. They had a range war to head off, not to mention keeping Rawhide Abbott from getting her pretty little hide shot full of holes. By the time Scratch got back to the marshal's office with the mounts, Pike had been let out of the cell and stood in the office stretching his back and swinging his tree trunk-like arms around.
Well, them cells is a mite crowded for a fella my size. You need to make them bigger.
You need to stop doing things to get arrested for. That would solve the problem.
I'll leave folks alone if they leave me alone. I never would have thrown that gambler through the window if he hadn't tried to cheat me.
I reckon you got a point there. But as big and strong as you are, Chesterfield, you got to realize that you can't just go around throwing people through windows and things like that. You might kill somebody one of these days, and I don't think you really want that. You might like to brawl a little now and then, but you're not a murderer.
I never murdered nobody.
And I'm sure you'd like to keep it that way. So think next time before you let your temper get the best of you.
What are you, huh? A preacher? You look a mite like a preacher with that black suit on.
Nope. Just a deputy who'd just as soon not have to lock you up again anytime soon.
Come on. We need to get moving. Rawhide's out there somewhere, maybe in the middle of a gun battle.
Marshall's right. We wasted time with all this jawing.
The four men went outside and swung up into their saddles. They drew plenty of attention as they rode out of town, heading north. For the second time today, Whiskey Flats lawmen were leaving with grim faces and determined attitudes. But they were headed in a different direction this time. Not to mention that the notorious Chesterfield Pike was accompanying them. They weren't just armed for bear this time. They had the next best thing to a grizzly riding with them. They kept the horses moving at a fast clip, so there wasn't really any opportunity for conversation. None of the men were interested in talking at the moment anyway. Bo and Scratch were worried about Rawhide, and Riley and Pike shared that concern. And if the mutual suspicion and dislike between the Star and the Rocking B-Spreads flared up into a shooting war, the hostilities were almost certain to spill over into the settlement, since Whiskey Flats was the only place in the area where either side could get supplies. When they had ridden for several miles, Pike pulled his mule back to a walk. The others followed suit. Now that the hooves weren't pounding so loudly, it was possible to talk.
We're about a mile from Bascom's ranch house. I've been doing some thinking, and since I'm helping you fellas out, it seems to me like I ought to be a deputy, too.
A deputy? Hell, you're our prisoner.
Well, not now. You done let me out.
I'm afraid that until there's a hearing, you're still considered to be in our custody, Chesterfield.
But you made Miss Rawhide a deputy after she helped you. I'm helping you, ain't I?
That doesn't mean you can be a deputy. Good Lord, you throw people through windows. Deputy can't behave like that.
Well, I'm gonna try to not lose my temper so easy from now on. Like Deputy Creel said, to tell you the truth, I'm a mite tired of folks looking at me like I'm some sort of monster every time I come into town. I can't even walk down the street without women grabbing their kids and almost running to get them away from me. Fellas on the boardwalk head for the other side of the street when they see me coming. And I may not look like it, but I got feelings too, you know?
You keep it up, Pike, and maybe someday you could be a deputy. Right now, though, you just think about getting us the Rockin' Bee as fast as you can.
We're pert near there. Bascom's Spread is right over that rise in front of us.
They were close, all right. Close enough to hear the sudden burst of gunshots that rang out in the afternoon air.
Some idiot had to start shooting. Let's get over there.
We're with you, Marshal.
Bo heeled the borrowed horse into a run again. Scratch was right beside him, and Chesterfield Pike brought up the rear, but not by much, as he banged his big feet against the mule's flanks. The four men charged up the hill, topped it, and thundered down the far slope. A valley spread out before them. A few hundred yards away lay the headquarters of Chet Bascom's Rocking Bee Spread. The ranch house, a long slab-sided bunkhouse, a cook shack, smokehouse, blacksmith shop, a couple of big barns, and numerous corrals. The place gave every appearance of being a fine, prosperous outfit. A far cry from the unfortunate Thompson family's hardscrabble layout on the other side of Whiskey Flats. At the moment, though, the Rocking Bee was a battlefield. A gray haze of powder smoke hung over the large open space between the main house and the barns. More smoke spurted from the windows of the house and the bunkhouse, as well as from the barns and around the corners of the other outbuildings. As veterans of countless such battles, Bo and Scratch needed only a glance to know what was going on. Bascom and his men were holed up in the main house and the bunkhouse, defending the Rocking Bee from Steve North's Star Ranch crew. Bascom and North might have had a parley before the shooting started, with North accusing Bascom of being behind the rustling. Almost certainly, Bascom would have fired back with the same accusation, laying all the blame for the missing cattle at North's feet. After that, it would have been only a matter of moments until the shooting started. There was no sign of Rawhide Abbott, which was good news as far as it went. At least the redhead wasn't lying dead on the ground between the house and the barns. She might still be in danger, though, if she'd been here when the fracas started. Bo held up a hand to signal a halt, and the others reined in.
If we go charging in down there, we won't accomplish anything except to get ourselves shot full of holes.
Well, what should we do?
This is the same sort of thing we ran into on our first day in Whiskey Flats. Remember, Marshall?
This fight is just on a lot larger scale.
Yeah, of course. We'll split up. If Find Bascom and North and force them to call off their men. Then we can figure out where to go from there.
We've never met Bascom or North. The only one of us who knows them by sight is Chesterfield here.
Bet you wish now you'd made me a deputy.
All right, damn it. Consider yourself a temporary deputy, all right?
Sure. And I'll be glad to give you a hand, Marshal.
That doesn't solve all the problems. There's only one at Chesterfield.
Damn right. When they made me, they busted the dang mold.
How about me and Pike find Steve North? If you and the Marshal can get in the house, Bo, you ought to be able to find Bascom without much trouble.
That's true. I got a hunch that Rawhide is in there, too. And she'll know Bascom. Good luck, boys.
The group parted. Bo and Riley riding to the left, so they could circle behind the ranch house. Scratch and Chesterfield Pike heading right, so they could close in on the barns from the rear. Down below, the shots continued to roar. Scratch and Pike followed a line of trees, staying behind the cover of the trunks for the most part. With the battle going on, Scratch didn't figure anybody around the Rockin' Bee headquarters would be paying too much attention to what was going on elsewhere, but it wouldn't hurt anything to be careful about their approach. When Scratch judged that they had gone far enough, he waved for Pike to follow him and turned his horse down the slope. This really was like the shootout between the hard cases at the Top Notch and Lariat's saloons, Scratch mused. Only, instead of a feisty red-headed gal siding him, he had the man-monster called Chesterfield Pike. Scratch suddenly realized that Pike wasn't armed.
You want to borrow my Winchester or one of my Remingtons?
Nah, I ain't much of a hand with guns. Revolver like that is plump puny, and I'm too clumsy to handle it. Rifle's almost as bad.
Well, I don't have a damn cannon to offer you. That might be the only thing big enough for you.
A cannon, huh? Too bad we don't have one. I bet it'd make them fellas stop shooting if I opened up on them with a cannon.
Uh-huh. Well, what are you gonna use if you have to fight?
Same thing I generally use. My fist.
Stay behind me anyway. I'll do my best to cover you.
Much obliged, but I don't need your help, Deputy. I can take care of myself.
Scratch didn't doubt that. Pike was big enough to handle most anything. They reined in and dismounted at the edge of the trees, about 50 yards behind the barns. Scratch spotted several men in range clothes, crouched behind some wagons parked next to one of the barns. They had rifles and handguns and were firing toward the house.
Let's see if we can cut down the odds of might first.
Pike grinned as he nodded his agreement, doubled his fists, and tapped them together in anticipation. Scratch drew his guns, crouched slightly, and headed toward the wagons at a run. Pike loped along beside him, barely doing more than walking since his long legs covered so much ground with each stride. The Star Cowboys didn't notice them coming until it was too late. Then one of the men must have caught a glimpse of them from the corner of his eye, because he suddenly twisted around.
Oh, look out, boys!
Before any of the rest of them could even react, Pike was on them. His fists lashed out with surprising speed, and two men went flying through the air as the blows connected with bone-crunching power. That left three men, and Pike grabbed two of them, lifting them off their feet and driving their heads together. The resounding thud that resulted as the men's skulls met would have made Scratch wince if there had been time. Instead, he was busy walloping the fifth and final man with one of his Remingtons. In a matter of a couple of heartbeats, Scratch and Pike had laid out five men, all of whom sprawled around in a senseless state.
All right, let's head for the back of the barn. If you see Steve North, let me know. If we can get our hands on him, chances are we can get the rest of his crew to hold their fire.
Pike nodded. He followed as Scratch made his way along the side of the barn to the back corner. They turned it and headed for the rear doors, which were closed. When they got there, Scratch tried to swing the doors open, but they refused to budge.
They must be barred inside.
That ain't a problem.
Pike wedged his fingers between the doors and heaved. They didn't give at first, so Pike threw more strength into them. The doors began to inch outward, creating a bigger gap between them and allowing Pike to get an even better grip on them. He seemed angered that the doors would dare to resist him. They didn't resist for long. The bar that held the doors closed inside broke in two. The doors flew outward with such speed that Scratch was glad he had decided to step back. Otherwise, he would have gotten hit by one of them. He wished there had been a quieter way in. The breaking bar had to have alerted some of the men inside the barn that they faced a new threat.